a large amount of money. She scoured the papers for notices of cottages to let and made careful note of the rents. She'd drawn up a budget, then calculated the lump sum she'd need to have saved in the bank in order to live on the interest. £400. In 3 years, she'd managed to save 57. Now she had the chance to walk away with £250 by Michaelmas. For that sum, she would shovel the Shepherd Market middens during the height of summer, naked. I have to go upstairs and pack my things. I've promised to report tomorrow morning.
Be careful of him, Alex, Nicola said. If he is truly a rake, as you say...
Believe me, there's nothing to fear. He isn't interested in me. He didn't even remember meeting me. Apparently, I was quite forgettable.
Stop! Penny stole Alex's hand.
I will hear none of that. You are not forgettable.
Dear sweet Penny, with her heart for lost and broken creatures, no doubt she recalled the name and personality of every last mouse in the cupboard. But most people weren't, Penny, and this wasn't the first time Alexandra had raised her hopes, only to be disappointed.
It doesn't matter whether he recalled me or not. I'll be looking after his wards. I will scarcely see him.
Oh, you will see him, Penny said, especially if you go wandering about the house at night. Try the library first.
Lock yourself in your room, Nicola countered. I'll make you a deadbolt.
Stop the both of you. I'm accepting a well-paid situation for the summer. Until yesterday I was setting clocks. Tomorrow I begin as a governess. It's not romantic. It's not dangerous. It's work.
You don't have to be sensible all the time, Penny said.
Easy enough to say. For a lady with a house of her own and £1,000 a year, Penny and Nicola didn't have to be sensible all the time, perhaps, but Alexandra did. She couldn't afford to be swept away. Fortunately, there was no longer any chance of that happening. Never mind that he'd ensorcelled every other woman in London. Alex knew better. Now that she'd seen his shameless nature, Chase Renaud had lost all appeal. She would never be tempted by him again. Not his smile, not his eyes, most certainly not his bare chest, nor his voice, forearms, wit, charm, or large feet, and not his warm, delicious-smelling coat either.
Oh, Alex, you are doomed.
Chapter 5
Alexandra reported for duty the following morning. This time she knew to knock at the front door, and to her profound relief, the housekeeper answered. Mrs. Greeley looked her up and down.
I thought you were the girl who sets clocks.
I was, Alexandra answered. Apparently now I'm a governess.
By the end of the day, you'll be the girl who sets clocks again.
She waved Alex toward the stairs.
Come then, I'll show you to the nursery. I'll have Jane prepare you a room, and Thomas will bring up your trunks in a bit.
Alex suspected Jane and Thomas would be waiting to see if she lasted the morning before they went to the trouble. When she entered the nursery today, she did not come upon another murder scene, thank goodness. This time, she had the chance to take a proper look at the surroundings, and what she took in left her breathless. The room was a fairyland, all done up in frothy white and buttery yellows and blushing pinks, like the window of a confectionery. White wainscoting lined the bottom half of the room, and here and there painted ivy tendrils climbed the sky-blue walls. The room offered no shortage of playthings. Alex saw rocking horses, miniature tea sets, and marionettes. An upholstered window seat had been wedged under one of the eaves, and beneath it ranged a shelf overflowing with books. Considering the freshness of the paint and the lavish quality of the furnishings, she deduced two things. First, the room had been done up expressly for these two girls. Second, no expense had been spared.
That one there is Rosamond, the housekeeper pointed to the elder of the two girls.
Rosamond sat reading a book in the window seat. She didn't look up.
And that's Daisy, Mrs. Greeley said.
Daisy acknowledged her, at least, dropping a slight curtsy. Her eyes, pale blue and wide as shillings, were downright unsettling. In her arms she cradled a doll, a quite expensive one, with a head carved from wood, covered with gesso,
and painted with rosy cheeks and red lips. Alexandra crossed the room to Daisy's side.
I'm most pleased to meet you, Daisy. This must be Millicent.
Daisy took a step in retreat.
Don't draw too near. She has consumption.
Consumption? I'm sorry to hear it. But I've no doubt you'll nurse her to a swift recovery. The girl shook her head gravely.
She'll be dead by tomorrow morning.
Surely she won't.
Oh, she will, Rosamond said dryly, speaking from the window seat. Best to have a few words prepared.
A few words prepared for what? Without moving her lips, Daisy made a few dry, hacking coughs.
Millicent needs quiet.
Yes, of course she does. Do you know what I hear is the best remedy for consumption? Fresh air and sunshine. A stroll to the park should set her up nicely. No outings, Mrs. Greeley declared. They're to focus on their lessons. Mr. Reynaud was very clear. Oh, well then, perhaps we can soothe Millicent another way. She thought on it. Perhaps tea with heaps of milk and sugar and a dish of custard. What do you think, Daisy? Shall we give it a go? No custard, Mrs. Greeley said. They're not allowed custard either.
That's Daisy's fault, Rosamond explained. She gave Millicent a nasty case of the grip and used it for phlegm.
Daisy shushed them all, clutching the doll tightly to her chest.
Please, allow her some peace in her final hours. I won't disturb your peace if you don't disturb mine, Rosamond said. You had better not wake me with hacking and wheezing in the middle of the night.
Now that she had Rosamond's attention, Alex decided to try with her. What are you reading?
A book.
She turned a page. Is it a story book?
No. It is a book of practical advice. How to torture your governess in 10 simple steps.
She's likely writing the second volume, Mrs. Greeley muttered. The cook will send up your luncheon at noon. The housekeeper disappeared, leaving Alexandra alone with her two young charges. Her stomach fluttered with nerves. Steady, she told herself. Rosamond and Daisy were only girls, after all. Girls who'd been orphaned and passed from home to home, guardian to guardian. If they greeted a newly arrived governess with mistrust, it was only natural. In fact, it was sensible. Alex had been an orphan, too. She understood. It would take time to build trust.
We won't have any lessons today, she announced. No lessons?
Rosamond lifted an eyebrow from behind her book.
What are we going to do all day?
Well, I intend to acquaint myself with the schoolroom, then perhaps write a letter or read a book. How you spend the day is yours to decide.
So you intend to bilk our guardian for wages while letting us do as we please?
The girl said.
I approve.
That is not my intent, but we have the whole summer for lessons. Of course, if you wish to begin today, I could... Rosamond put her nose back in her book. Alex was relieved. The truth was, she had no idea where to even start. Being a governess hadn't sounded so difficult last night. She had an education, after all. But now that she was here, she felt at a loss. While the girls were occupied, Alex had a look at her surroundings. One side of the space had been designated as a schoolroom. She found it furnished with just as much attention and thought as the nursery. Two child-sized writing desks, an adult-sized table with a wide flat top, and a bedsheet-sized slate hanging on the wall. On the slate in careful script, someone had chalked 5 words. Letters. Ciphers. Geography. Comportment. Needlework. Alex moved onto a world map affixed to the wall. The continents were peppered with tacks in a seemingly random arrangement. Malta, Finland, Timbuktu, a speck of an island in the Indian Ocean, the Sahara Desert. Daisy appeared at her elbow.
Those are the places Mr. Reynaud says he's sending us to boarding school.
Alex considered the options. Well, if I were you, I'd take Malta in a heartbeat. It's quite lovely, surrounded by azure seas.
You've been to Malta?
I've been to all sorts of places. My father was a sea captain. Alex rearranged the tacks, pushing them into common trading ports. Macau, Lima, Lisbon, Bombay, and I was born near here. She placed the final tack.
Where's that?
Read for yourself. Daisy flashed a glance over her shoulder, then whispered,
I can't.
Manila. Alex sounded out the syllables for her. It's a port in the Philippine Islands. 7 years old and she couldn't read yet. Oh, dear. Say, Daisy, I'm wondering if we have enough pencils and bits of chalk. Would you help me count them out?
Daisy, Rosamund interrupted sharply. I think I hear Millicent coughing.
As her sister went to nurse her ailing patient, Rosamund fixed Alex with an unflinching and unmistakable look.
Stay away from my sister.
Alex's spirits dipped. The challenge before her was already intimidating. She had no teaching experience. The younger of her two charges had not yet learned to read, and her employer would be completely unhelpful. However, it was plain that the most formidable obstacle in this entire endeavour would come in the shape of a mistrustful, strong-willed, 10-year-old girl. So, the war of wills began here. If she didn't want to leave this house penniless, it was a war Alexandra had to win. Chapter 6. That evening, Chase stood in the doorway of his governess's bedchamber, waging a fierce battle with temptation. He'd stopped by her room with the most innocent of motives. He'd intended to see that she'd settled in and be assured that the accommodations were to her liking. What he was doing, however, was admiring her sweet, round little bottom. It wasn't as though he'd intended to ogle her. He wasn't some perverse old man leering through a peephole in the closet. Her door was open and her back was to him, and she hadn't taken note of his presence. Probably because she was bent over that cursed telescope. So there it was, presented for his view. The most delightful peach of a backside. More generously rounded than he would have guessed, given her slender figure. At his side, his hands instinctively cupped, estimating size and plumpness. Chase, you despicable bastard. He shook out his hands and cleared his throat. Miss Mountbatten. Startled, she stood bolt upright and reeled to face him.
Mr. Reynaud.
So, do you like what you see?
Do I like what I...
Her gaze wandered over him. In his evening attire, he could only imagine he made a markedly different picture than he had on their first meeting. He'd actually bathed and shaved, and gone to the trouble of buttoning his cuffs. She stammered.
That is to say, I should imagine that...
The room, he said. Does it meet with your satisfaction?
Oh, that, she said with relief. Yes, thank you very much. I wasn't expecting something so spacious.
Mrs. Greeley usually gives the governess a chamber next to the nursery, but I told her you required the one with the largest window and a clear view of the sky. I'll send up a maid to assist you in unpacking your things.
I've already unpacked them, she replied, looking self-conscious. There was only the one trunk.
Oh, yes, of course. He strolled across the room to the window, taking a look at the arrangement of the telescope and window. There's space out here for a narrow veranda. I'll have plans drawn up for a platform and railing this week.
That's too generous of you.
Nothing of the sort. It's entirely self-interest. If you're satisfied with your accommodations, you're less likely to leave. He bent and squinted to peer through the telescope. Why did you want it? I can't help but be curious.
Well, our agreement is temporary. At the end of the summer, I will need a new occupation.
I should think you'd go back to setting clocks. She shook her head.
I'm planning a new business venture. Instead of selling the time, I'm going to sell comets.
Selling comets? He laughed a little. Oh, I must hear this. Pray tell, how do you intend to catch them?
The aristocrats are positively mad for comets, but most don't have the time or interest in doing the work. I'll search the skies and chart observations, and then I'll find a patron willing to pay me for the effort.
So, you'll find the comet, and this patron claims it as his discovery? That sounds highly unjust.
I'm not interested in it for the glory. A woman of my station has to be more practical than that.
So you intend to be an astronomical mercenary? I'm impressed.
She smiled a little. That makes it sound far too exciting. It's boring work, a matter of searching the sky one dark patch at a time, looking for anything smudgy.
Smudgy? A proper scientific term, that.
I'll show you an example, if you like.
She joined him, crowding into the small window alcove, and bent to adjust the telescope, affording him, should he choose to take it, a view directly down the neckline of her frock. Chase pulled his gaze away, but not swiftly enough. That split-second view of two celestially perfect crescents of soft feminine flesh was going to linger. In need of distraction, he swept a gaze around the room, which in its own way was equally revealing. This was the sum total of her possessions? The bedchamber remained empty for the most part, save for a simple dressing set on the washstand, a row of books and writing supplies on the corner table, and a few articles of clothing hanging on pegs. On the wall above the table, she'd affixed items clipped from newspapers and magazines, a map of the constellations, a card with an illustration commemorating the appearance of Halley's Comet in 1759, and a few smaller notices that he had to squint to read from this distance. At the top of one, he could just make out the words, "Cottage for Let."
"Here it is. Have a look if you like."
She beckoned him to look through the eyepiece. Chase bent awkwardly, closed one eye and peered into the brass tube. His reward was a blurry glimpse of a wholly unremarkable speck of light. "Apparently I'm a natural astronomer. I can declare with certainty," he squinted, "that is a smudgy sky thing. I shall expect to imminently receive my medal from the Royal Astronomical Society."
"That's not a comet. Most of the smudges aren't. Before declaring it a new discovery, you have to rule out the other possibilities. Fortunately, others have done much of that work. There's a book by a Frenchman, Charles Messier. He catalogued a great many of the known not-a-comet smudges, so that comet-hunting observers know to ignore them." She went to retrieve a folio from the table and flipped through the pages for him to view.
"You said a book. That's not a book."
"I couldn't find a copy I could afford to purchase," she admitted. "So I borrowed it from a circulating library and copied it out by hand. After consulting Messier, one must check against lists of identified comets. If it's not among those, then you can report your smudge to the Royal Observatory for verification. Even then, 9 times in 10, it will have already been claimed."
"And the smudges that aren't comets, what are they?"
"Nebulae, mostly, or star clusters."
"I'm afraid you'll have to define these things if you want me to have any idea what you're talking about. Alternatively, you can simply go on talking while I stare at your earlobe." She blushed.
"You needn't trouble yourself."
"It's no chore." He crossed his arms and leaned back against the window casing. "I'm a veritable connoisseur of earlobes, and yours is rather nice."
"I meant you needn't pretend to be interested, Mr. Reynaud. Clearly you have an engagement this evening, and I don't wish to delay you."
"I'm not pretending. I'm finding this conversation most fascinating, even though a great deal of it is lost on me." That wasn't precisely the truth. He was finding Alexandra Mountbatten fascinating, and nothing about her was lost on him. He wasn't all that interested in gazing at the sky himself, but he was captivated by the experience of watching her gazing at the sky. Her figure and earlobe weren't the half of it. Standing this close, he could detect the faintest hint of orange flower water about her. Not enough to qualify as a perfume, just the suggestion that she scented her bath water with a few sparing drops, an amount carefully poised between the indulgence of a small feminine luxury and the economy required to make a small vial last for months. A tiny, beaded, cross-shaped pendant was tied about her neck with a narrow satin ribbon just long enough for the coral beads to nestle at the base of her throat. Again, that balance between prettiness and practicality. The best quality ribbon she could likely afford, purchased in the smallest possible amount. Damn, she would be a delight to spoil. If she weren't his employee, he could shower her with little gifts and luxuries, remove all the small worries that came between her and the sky. "Do go on," he said. "I'm listening. And looking and noticing."
"Nebulae are clouds of stardust floating in space. Star clusters are just as they sound. Stars appear so close together in the sky they're sometimes mistaken for one object. My favourite smudge, however, isn't a nebula or cluster. It's Messier's number 40, a double star, perhaps even a binary star."
"Oh, truly?"
And with that, he was back to the earlobe. She bent to peer through the eyepiece. A binary star is created when two stars are drawn together. Once they come near enough, neither one can resist the other's pull. They're stuck together forever, destined to spend eternity revolving about each other like dancers in a waltz, I suppose. She scribbled a note in her notebook. The fascinating thing is, a binary star's center of gravity isn't in one star or the other. It's in the empty space between them.
He was silent for a while. I'll be damned. You were right when you scolded me for letting this instrument go to waste.
I'm glad you see its value now.
Absolutely. To think I could have been using it to seduce women all along.
To her chastening look, he replied,
Come now. All that waltzing star business, it's deuced romantic.
I would never have marked you as a romantic.
I suppose it's all that glory of the universe talk. Makes a man feel rather small and insignificant. And that makes a man want to grab the nearest woman and prove himself to be otherwise.
Their gazes met, and they both became keenly aware of the obvious. She was the nearest woman. He was not, absolutely not, going to pursue his governess. Yes, he was a rake, but for a gentleman, chasing after the house staff wasn't rakish behaviour. It was repulsive.
The girls, he blurted out, breaking the tension. How was your first day?
Challenging.
I don't doubt it.
Can you tell me something about their interests or their schooling, anything at all?
They've had little proper schooling, but are somehow far too clever despite it. Their interests are mischief, disease, petty thievery, and plotting crimes against the house staff.
She laughed a little. You speak as though they're hardened criminals.
They're well on their way to it. But now you're here to take them in hand. I have every faith in you, Miss Mountbatten.
He patted her shoulder gamely.
I've seen your natural talent as a disciplinarian.
She cringed. Yes, about that.
If you're intending to apologize, don't. I richly deserved all your censure and then some. I wish I could say you've already seen me at my worst, but that's nowhere near the case. However, I do wish to say one thing.
Yes. She gave him her full attention, and she had an intimidating amount of attention to give. Only natural, he supposed. Here was a woman willing to stare into dark emptiness night after night, on the hope that some day some tiny speck might shine back. As she gazed at him, Chase found himself wishing he could reward her observation. Only darkness here, darling. Don't waste your time.
If my reputation worries you, he said, as much for his own benefit as hers, it needn't. Seducing you would never even cross my mind.
She nodded. Thank you for your assurances, Mr. Raynaud. I appreciate them very much indeed.
Chapter 7. Seducing you would never even cross my mind. What a perfectly timed reminder. Really, the man had a way of withering Alexandra's pride to a dried-up husk. One moment he was listening to her babble away about comets, hanging on her words and complimenting her earlobe, and the next he left her with a few parting words to remind her that she was a fool. Embroidery wasn't her favourite hobby. But Alex planned to stitch those words on a sampler and hang it above her bed. Seducing you would never even cross my mind. Mr. Charles Raynaud, 1817. She no longer wondered at his popularity with women. Devilish charm simply radiated from him, like one of nature's essential forces. Gravity, magnetism, electricity. Chase Raynaud's masculine appeal. His every lopsided grin or low teasing word sent a frisson of excitement rushing along her skin. That alone wouldn't be a problem. But then her brain caught up all those sensations, rolled them into a ball, and set it on a shelf. As if that quivering mass of feminine reaction was something that deserved to take up space. As if it needed a name. Well, Alexandra would label it, right this moment. I-D-I-O-C-Y. Idiocy. She heard the creak of a door down at street level, and she gave in to the temptation to peer over her windowsill. There he stood, waiting on the pavement in that immaculately tailored black topcoat. He gave his cuffs a smart tug, and ran a hand through his tawny brown hair. A pair of matched bays pulled a fashionable blue lacquered phaeton around from the mews,
and the groom handed him the reins. Off he went to spend his evening enjoying the company of others, and here Alex was left mooning over him like a fool. She readied herself for bed and put out the candle, and then she lay awake far too long, listening for the sounds of a returning phaeton or the creak of a door. Not that it was any of her concern what time he returned home, or whether he returned at all. She must have fallen asleep at some point, because she woke to the sensation of someone poking her in the arm, repeatedly. She opened her eyes halfway.
"Rosamond? Is that you?"
"She's dead."
Now Alex was awake. She sat bolt upright in bed.
"Dead?"
"Millicent. The consumption took her overnight." "The doll. She meant the doll. You gave me a fright."
Alex pressed a hand to her chest. Perhaps her heart would stop racing in a day or two.
"The funeral is prepared. We'll be waiting on you in the nursery."
"Funeral?" Rosamond was gone before Alex could inquire further. She rose from bed and hastily dressed. Given her disorientation in a new room and the abrupt way she'd been roused from sleep, she didn't do a very good job of it. After two attempts, she decided she could live with misaligned buttons for the moment, and three passes of the hairbrush would have to be enough. Clenching a few hairpins in her teeth, she made her way into the corridor, winding her hair into a knot as she went. Alex hoped the standard of attire at this funeral wasn't overly formal. She just jabbed the second pin into her haphazard chignon when she entered the nursery. Millicent lay in the center of the bed, staring up blankly from the swaddling of her shroud. The girl stood on either side. Daisy wore a scrap of black lace netting draped over her head as a veil. Alex struggled mightily not to burst out laughing, if for no other reason than doing so would launch the remaining hairpins in her mouth like missiles. She completed her upsweep, composed herself, and approached the bed. To Rosamond, she whispered,
"What happens now?"
"We're waiting on..."
A male voice breezed into the room. "Such a tragedy. Deepest sympathies. A grievous loss." Mr. Raynaud had joined the group. Alex slid a cautious glance in his direction. He wore the same black coat and boots he'd been wearing the night previous. His cuffs were undone, however, and his cravat was missing. Probably draped over an antler prong somewhere. He walked toward Daisy and made a deep bow of condolences before holding out his arm so that she could pin something around it. A black armband. She recalled his words from a few days ago. "Millicent is Daisy's doll. She kills the thing at least once a day." So this is why he'd been wearing the black armband a few mornings past, when they'd conducted that farce of an interview in his not-at-all-a-gentleman's retreat. He hadn't been in mourning, not for a human being at any rate. Perhaps she shouldn't have judged him quite so harshly. He bent to place a kiss on Millicent's painted forehead. "Bless her soul. She looks just as though she's sleeping. Or awake. Or doing anything else, really." Alex's mouth twitched at the corners, but she bowed her head and tried to appear bereaved.
"Let us begin," Daisy said solemnly.
They formed a semicircle at the foot of the bed. Rosamond went to Daisy's right side. Mr. Raynaud assumed what was clearly his usual place at Daisy's left, which put him next to Alexandra. She didn't want to think about where he'd been since she saw him last, but her senses gave her no choice in the matter. When she inhaled, she smelled brandy and sandalwood, and the suggestion that he'd walked through a cloud of cheroot smoke. She didn't detect any hint of a lady's perfume, however. That should not have come as a relief, but it did. She stared at the bedpost and set her mind on tragedy.
"Mr. Raynaud, would you kindly say a few words?"
Daisy asked.
"But of course."
He clasped his hands together and intoned in a low, grave voice,
"Almighty Father, we are gathered here today to commend your keeping the soul of Millicent Fairfax."
Daisy nudged him with her elbow.
"Millicent Annabel Chrysanthemum Genevieve Fairfax," he corrected.
Alexandra bit the inside of her cheek. How could the man keep a straight face through all this?
"She will be remembered for her faithful companionship. A truer friend never lived. Not once did she stray from Daisy's side, save for the few occasions when she rolled off the bed."
Oh, help. Alex was going to laugh. She knew it. Biting her tongue clean through wouldn't help. Perhaps she could disguise a burst of laughter as a cough,
After all, consumption was catching. Let Millicent's composure in the face of certain death be a model for us all. Her eyes remained fixed on heaven, and not merely because she lacked any eyelids to close. She cast a pleading glance at him, only to catch him glancing back with devilish amusement. He wanted her to laugh, the terrible man, and then, just as she thought she was lost, he took her hand in his, lacing their fingers into a tight knot. Alex no longer worried she might laugh. Instead, her heart squeezed. On Mr. Raynaud's other side, Daisy clasped her guardian's hand tight. Then she offered her free hand to Rosamond. The four of them had formed an unbroken chain. And Alex realized the truth. Here were three people who desperately need each other, perhaps even loved each other, and they would all rather contract consumption than admit it. Daisy bowed her veiled head.
Let us pray.
Alex fumbled her way through the Lord's Prayer, quietly reeling. His grip was so warm and firm, his signet ring pressed against her third and fourth fingers. The moment felt intimate. The way they stood holding hands, heads bowed in prayer, it felt less like a funeral, and more like a wedding. No, no, no. What was wrong with her? Had she learned nothing from those months of foolish imaginings? All those silly fantasies had popped like a soap bubble when it became clear he'd forgotten her completely. Chase Raynaud was not the man of her dreams. By his own declaration, he would never even think of seducing her. She really needed to start on that sampler. Lead us not into temptation, Alex prayed fervently, but deliver us from evil. When the prayer was done, Daisy placed a deceased doll reverently in a toy chest grave. Mr. Raynaud kept Alexandra's hand in his. Well then, Miss Mountbatten, now that's over with, I shall leave you to your pupils. He gave her hand a light squeeze before releasing it. Let the education begin. Chapter 8. The education was on hold. Before any lessons could take place, Alexandra had a 10-year-old girl to conquer. After breakfast, the Rosamond Rebellion commenced. Silence was her first strategy, and she'd marshaled Daisy into the campaign. Neither of them would speak a word to Alex. Indeed, once the funeral was over, neither of them even acknowledged her presence. Rosamond read her book, Daisy exhumed Millicent, and all three treated Alex as if she didn't exist. Very well. Both sides could play at this game. The next day, Alex didn't even try to start conversation. Instead, she brought a novel and a packet of biscuits. Nicola had sent her off with a full hamper of them, and she sat in the rocking chair to read. She laughed aloud at the funny bits, really, pigeons, gasped at the revelations, and loudly chewed her way through a dozen biscuits. At one point, she was certain she felt Daisy gazing at her from across the room. However, she didn't dare look up to confirm it. It became a habit. Every day, Alex brought with her a novel, and every day a different variety of Nicola's biscuits. Lemon, almond, chocolate, toffee. And every day, as she sat eating and reading, the girls ignored her existence. Until the morning, a foul odour permeated the nursery, a sharp scent that even fresh-baked biscuits had no hope to overpower. As the day grew warmer, the ripe, pungent smell became nauseating. The girls offered no clue as to its origin, and Alexandra would not give Rosamond the satisfaction of asking. Instead, she sniffed and searched until she found the source. A bit of clammy, shrunken Stilton buried in her bottommost desk drawer. Well then, it would seem the tactics were escalating. She could rise to the challenge. Alex had exhausted her supply of biscuits. She brought in a new box of watercolours, bright as jewels in a treasure chest, placing them in easy reach. The girls dusted her chair with soot. Alex bought a litter of kittens Mrs. Greeley was evicting from the cellar. No one could resist fluffy, mewling kittens. And Daisy almost didn't, until Rosamond yanked her away with a stern word. That evening, a rotting plum mysteriously appeared in Alex's slipper, and unfortunately her bare toes found it. Rosamond seemed to be daring her to shout or rage or go complaining to Mr. Raynaud. However, Alex refused to surrender. Instead, she smiled. She allowed the girls to do as they pleased. And she waited.
When they were ready to learn, they would tell her so. Until then, she would only be wasting her effort. At last, her patience was rewarded. She found her opening. Rosamond fell asleep on a particularly warm afternoon, dozing off with her book propped on her knees and her head tilted against the window glazing. Alex motioned Daisy closer and laid out a row of wrapped sweetmeats on the table, one by one.
"How many are there?" she whispered. "Count them out for me, and you may have them for yourself."
Daisy sent a cautious glance toward her sister.
"She's sleeping. She'll never know."
With a small, uncertain finger, Daisy touched each sweet as she counted aloud.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And in this group? Daisy's lips moved as she counted them quietly to herself.
6.
Well done, you. Now, how many in both groups together? Together, 5 and 6 are...
Daisy!
Rosamond snapped. Startled, Daisy snatched her hand behind her back.
Yes? Millicent's vomiting up her innards. You'd better see to her.
As her sister obediently retreated, Rosamond approached Alexandra.
I know what you're doing.
I never imagined otherwise.
You won't win.
Win? I'm not certain what you mean.
We will not cooperate. We are not going away to school.
Alex softened her demeanour. Why don't you want to go to school?
Because the school won't want us. We've been sent down from 3 schools already, you know.
Don't say you'd rather remain here with Mr. Raynaud. If it were up to him, you'd have only dry toast at every meal.
We're not wanted by Mr. Raynaud either. No one wants us anywhere, and we don't want them.
Alexandra recognised the defiance and mistrust in the girl's eyes. A dozen years ago, those eyes could have mirrored her own. A tender part of her wanted to clutch the girl close. Of course you're wanted. Of course you're loved. Your guardian cares for you so very much. But to lie would be taking the coward's way out, and Rosamond wouldn't be fooled. What the girl needed wasn't false reassurance. It was for someone to tell her the honest, unflinching truth. Very well. Alex folded her hands on the desk and faced her young charge. You're right. You've been passed around from relation to relation, sent down from 3 schools, and Mr. Raynaud wishes to rid himself of you at the first opportunity. You're unwanted. So what you must decide is this. What do you want? Rosamond gave her a suspicious look. I was orphaned too. A bit older than you are now, but I was utterly alone in the world, save for a few distant relations who paid for my schooling, on the condition that they would never have me in their sight. It wasn't fair. It was lonely, and my schoolmates were cruel, and I cried myself to sleep more evenings than not. But in time, I realized I had an advantage over the other girls. They had to worry about catching a husband to help their families. I was indebted to no one. I answered to no one, and I needn't meet anyone's expectations of what a young lady should or shouldn't be. My life was my own. I could follow any dream if I was prepared to work hard for it. Do you hear what I'm saying? Rosamond gave no acknowledgement, but Alex could tell the girl was listening, intently. So what is it you truly want? If you could have any life you wished, what would it be?
I want to escape. Not just this house, but England.
Where do you mean to go?
Anywhere, everywhere. I'd take Daisy with me. We'd travel the world, wearing trousers and smoking cheroots and doing as we pleased.
Alexandra had been hoping to hear, I want to be a painter. Or a French-trained chef, or an architect. Whatever pursuit Rosamond named, Alex could build lessons on its foundation, but she was quite certain Mr. Raynaud would not approve of lessons in cheroot smoking. Alex wouldn't have known how to give them anyway. That sounds like a grand life indeed, she said. But how will you support yourselves?
I'm perfectly capable of looking after us both.
Rosamond cast a glance at the table.
So you can clear away your 9 sweets and leave us alone.
You know very well there are 11 sweetmeats.
Are there?
Alex looked. Sure as could be, 2 sweetmeats were missing. The girl had managed to steal them right from under her nose, and one of the 2 was already across the room in Daisy's hands. Alex could hear the paper crinkling as the younger girl unwrapped it. Rosamond, may I tell you something? You may find yourself reluctant to believe it, but it's the truth. The girl gave a lackadaisical shrug, the warmest gesture she'd made toward Alex so far.
I like you, Alexandra said. I like you very much indeed.
Chapter 9. Alex woke to darkness. Disorientation wrapped her brain like a fog. She sat up and shook her head, trying to clear it. Her heart pounded. Perspiration glued her shift to her chest. Worst of all, her stomach pitched and rolled, as if she were at sea. Dread rose within her, quickly transforming, thanks to nature's least helpful of alchemies, into panic. She fumbled blindly, finding nothing familiar. Her hands grasped bedclothes of the softest flannel, definitely not her own. Her feet found a solid floor, but as she stood, the floorboards didn't creak beneath her weight. Then her knee collided with a chest of drawers. Ouch! The pain gave her racing thoughts a jolt.
Calm yourself, Alexandra.
She pressed one hand to her belly and mentally sank through each solid, immovable layer beneath her feet. Wooden floor, stony plinth foundation, cobbled London street. The same layer of grainy, musty earth that Romans had packed beneath their sandals and the bedrock atlas supporting the city on his shoulders.
There now. You're fine, you ninny.
She wasn't lost at sea. She was in the Reynold residence, and she was a governess. An underqualified, ill-prepared, and thus far unsuccessful governess, but a governess nonetheless. When she swallowed, her tongue rasped against the roof of her mouth. She was also a thirsty governess. By now, Alex's eyes had adjusted to the dark. She went to the washstand and lifted the ewer. It was light in her grip, no sound of sloshing. Empty. Drat. Tomorrow she'd be certain to set a cup of water aside before she retired. But that wouldn't help her now. She supposed she might ring for a maid, but she hated to bother the staff. She squinted at her compact travelling clock on the washstand. Already 5 in the morning. She could wait another hour until sunrise, couldn't she? Her parched throat objected. No, she couldn't wait. To most people, the sensation of thirst was an inconvenience. But then, most people didn't know the minute-by-minute torture of going without water for days at a stretch. Alex slid her feet into a pair of worn slippers and made her way out of the bedchamber, through the corridor, and down the stairs with silent footsteps. Being small-statured had a few benefits, and stealth was one of them. In the kitchen, she found the kettle on the stove. It still held some cooled water. She gulped down one cupful, then a second, and yet another still. Once her thirst was slaked, she turned to make her way back upstairs. Thump, thump. She eyed the closed door to Mr. Reynold's private retreat. Thump, thump, thump. The dull rhythmic sound ceased, and then started anew, and, despite her misgivings, Alex put her ear to the door. Now the thumping sounded more like banging, something hitting the wall again and again, not just banging, but intermittent grunting. She shouldn't be listening to this. But she couldn't pry her ear from the door. The sense of sordid fascination was irresistible. All went quiet once again. She pressed her ear tightly to the door and held her breath, eliminating the distracting sound of her own inhalation. Then, bang, bang, bang! Crash! And a deep, harsh sound that was part growl, part barbaric shout. She clapped her hands to her mouth. She was so absorbed by the struggle not to laugh, she didn't notice the heavy footfalls until they were just on the other side of the door. The door latch turned. No time for escape. The door swung open. She jumped back, clapping both hands over her eyes. I didn't see anything. I swear it, she said. I didn't see anything at all. Chase stared at his governess. She stood there with a finger blindfold clamped over her eyes, dressed in a simple shift. Shadows skimmed contours of the form beneath it.
I should think snooping is beneath you, Miss Mountbatten.
I'm sorry, she said, still covering her eyes. I'm so sorry. I only came down for a drink of water, I promise.
Pressing one's ear to a door would seem an ineffective way to quench thirst.
Her shoulders wilted.
I didn't mean to intrude. And I didn't see anything, hand to my heart. I'll be going to my chamber straight away.
She covered both eyes with one hand and groped comically with the other.
Turn me around, if you would.
Are we playing blind man's buff?
No.
Her throat flushed red.
Turn me in the other direction toward the door. Point me back the way I came and I'll go up to bed.
Chase went to the basin and worked the pump handle. The scene was so absurd he'd nearly forgotten the throbbing pain in his hand.
I can't send you to bed yet. I'm in need of your assistance.
She swallowed audibly.
Assistance?
I can't deal with this one-handed.
She reeled a step in retreat, colliding with a shelf of copper butter moulds, setting them a-rattle. Even though she'd backed herself into a corner, she still wouldn't lower her hands from her eyes.
Can't your guest provide you some relief?
His guest?
I don't have a guest. A single finger peeled away from her face. He caught a glimpse of dark eyelashes through the gap.
I thought you were entertaining a visitor, she said.
He looked at the door to his retreat, then back to her.
Why would you think that?
I heard...
She swallowed and whispered faintly.
Banging and groaning.
Good God,
he chuckled. If you hope to hear something salacious, I'll have to disappoint you. I was hanging panelling on the wall with a hammer and nails, and I seem to have sliced my thumb, hence the groaning.
Oh,
she lowered her hands and gave a nervous laugh.
Thank heavens, what a relief. I mean, I'm not relieved about your wound, of course. I'm sorry about that. I'm just glad you're not...
Bare to my skin and covered in well-earned sweat?
Yes.
He gritted his teeth. He would have loved to draw out the amusement, but his thumb wouldn't be ignored any longer. The cook keeps a bit of plaster up there. He jutted his chin toward a high shelf atop the cupboard. If you'd kindly fetch it for me. She didn't do as he asked, but approached him and had a look at his wound.
You can't just smear plaster over this.
It's a small wound.
But a deep one. It must be cleaned thoroughly.
It's fine.
I've seen wounds like this one fester. Bigger and stronger men have succumbed to less.
It's truly none of your concern, he said, growing testy at the suggestion of her tending the wounds of bigger and stronger men.
It is my concern. If you die of gangrene or lockjaw, I'll never be paid.
Fair enough.
He offered her his hand for dressing. She washed the wound thoroughly with boiled water from the kettle and strong lye scullery soap.
He winced. Damn! Bugger! Blast!
Then she slipped the flask from his waistcoat pocket.
May I?
Having uncapped it, she lifted it to his lips. To his quizzical expression, she replied, You're going to want it. This will hurt. Chase took a sip. He wasn't about to admit any pain, but he wouldn't refuse a swallow of good brandy. As he watched, she poured a stream of amber spirits directly into his wound, letting it trickle until it overflowed. Then she pressed the wound to purge more blood and did it again. On the outside, Chase was determined to look manful and impervious to pain. On the inside, Christ! When she capped the brandy and set the flask aside, he exhaled with relief. She turned to search the kitchen stores.
Now for some vinegar. Bloody hell.
He winced as she began her fresh round of torture.
How are the girls' lessons coming along?
Slowly. I've been attempting to earn their confidence, but they have the sort of wounds that won't be easily healed. How long ago did their parents die?
I've no idea, he admitted. I don't even know if they're orphans. They could be illegitimate.
They're not?
She broke off, abandoning the query.
Mine? He shuddered at the suggestion. I would still have been at school when Rosamond was born. It's true that I possess a natural talent for seduction, but I wasn't that precocious. All I know is their father never claimed them, and the woman they called mother died 3 years ago, and they've been passed around relations and schools ever since.
She clucked her tongue.
Despite all their mischief, I pity them.
You ought to be pitying me, he thought.
Having a woman this enticing living under the same roof was a constant temptation, and Chase battled temptation with approximately the same success as a seagull battling the Royal Navy. Out of sight was not out of mind. At night, he found himself thinking of her, upstairs, alone, in the dark. But worse, by far, were the mornings. For God's sake, he began each day holding her hand. That and trying like hell to make her laugh. He hadn't managed it quite yet, but most days he wrangled a reluctant smile. That alone was worth four flights of stairs. Just yesterday, Rosamond had woken him with a single word.
Tapeworms.
He'd all but leapt to his feet with delight. It wasn't entirely desire, but it was partly desire. He knew an innocent outward appearance often concealed a tightly coiled spring waiting for release. In the dark of night, with that virginal shift unbuttoned and that plait of dark hair unbound, Alexandra Mountbatten might prove surprising. No sooner had he conjured the image than she untied the strip of linen holding the end of her plait. As her hair came unbound and fell loose, he stared at a lock of black satin dipping to graze the slope of her neck. She pursed her lips and blew over his wound to dry it. God almighty. There's no doubt that they're clever, she went on, winding this strip of linen about his thumb. But life's taught them some difficult lessons. One only needs to look at Millicent to know Daisy's hurting. It's obvious from spending mere minutes with Rosamond that she's learned to be wary. She won't lower her guard easily. It will take time and patience to gain her trust.
You have until Michaelmas.
We have until Michaelmas. She deftly tucked the strip of linen in on itself, securing the binding.
Disciplining children is not among my talents. That's why I hired you to take them in hand.
She looked up at him. Maybe they don't need to be taken in hand, but taken into someone's heart.
Heart? He tugged his hand from hers. Oh, no. Don't get ideas.
Goodness, heaven forbid that a woman have ideas.
Ideas are all well and good, but not those ideas. I know that look in a woman's eye. I've seen it before many times. You think you can convince me to settle down?
You don't need to settle down. My father was a sea captain. I was raised on a ship sailing the globe. We were the least settled family in the world, and yet I never doubted his love for me.
Wait, you were raised aboard a ship sailing the globe?
She paused in the act of packing up the unused salves and plaster. I probably shouldn't have mentioned that.
No, I think you should have mentioned it, and long before now.
Does it truly matter? Perhaps I had an unconventional upbringing, but that doesn't mean I can't perform my duties. I had a full education, here in England, at a proper school. I did warn you I wasn't gently bred, and you said you didn't care. Her voice went small but resonant with emotion. Mr. Raynaud, I need this post. Please don't sack me.
Don't be ridiculous. I have no intention of sacking you. That's not what I meant.
It isn't?
No. You should have told me straight away, because you should tell everyone straight away. If I had your life story, it would be the first thing I mentioned to anyone. Hello, I'm Chase Raynaud. I learned to toddle aboard a merchant ship, and the seven seas rocked my cradle. And have I mentioned that no tropical sunset could compare with your beauty? The women would fall into bed with me.
Don't they fall into bed with you anyway?
That's true, but they might do a half minute faster.
Over months and years, those half minutes add up.
So, let's hear the rest of the tale.
She put away the soap and vinegar. My father was American. After the revolution...
The rebellion, he corrected.
He became a seaman. He'd worked his way up to first mate when they anchored in Manila Harbour. Theirs was one of the first ships to open trade with the Philippine Islands. Aside from the Spaniards, of course. Anyhow, they anchored for a few months. That's where he met my mother, and they fell in love.
She was a Spanish colonist, then?
Mestiza. My grandfather was Spanish, but my grandmother was native to the island.
Fascinating.
This information solved a few mysteries that had been lingering in Chase's mind.
Life on a trading ship would have taught her the value of goods. Everything from the ribbon around her neck to telescopes and comets.
He supposed her mother had blessed her with that bounty of dark hair and her delicate snub of a nose, and her father was likely to blame for her stubborn, independent streak. Those Americans just wouldn't be told what to do.
So, if your father was American, and he met your mother in the Philippine Islands, how did you come to be living in England?
That's a long story. He looked pointedly at his bandaged hand.
I won't be doing any more work tonight.
She paused. After they married, my father sailed back to Boston. He promised to return once he'd found a partner and bought a ship of his own. It was only supposed to be a year, but in the end it took him more than three. When he finally returned, he found that my mother had died. He was no longer a husband.
But he'd become a father.
She nodded. Most men would have left me to be raised by my mother's family, but my father would have none of it.
He took me aboard his ship and off we went. The Esperanza was our home for the next decade. He named it for her. She smiled a little. The same way my mother had named me after him. His name was Alexander.
That's appallingly romantic,
isn't it? And if you think that's treacly, wait for this part. My father went down with the Esperanza in a storm. Died in the embrace of his true love, you could say. And that's how I ended up in England.
Hold a moment, there are a few bits missing from that story. Such as the part that would tell him who to blame for stranding her in a strange country alone, and whether that someone was still alive and available to be pummeled.
She changed the subject. How did your parents meet?
Let's see. Chase drummed his fingers on the table. My father was a second son. He had connections but no money. He found a young woman with money but no connections. He proposed, she accepted, they were married. A year later, I came along. And then we all lived miserably ever after.
She was quiet for a moment. I like my story better.
I like yours better too. But coming back to the matter at hand, my history should only underscore the point. I've no idea what a family looks like. I cannot be a satisfactory guardian. Hell, I don't even have dogs. Commitment isn't in my nature.
You're simply too virile to be tied down, is that it? Her eyes teased him. Must be all those antlers.
Don't make light of it, he said in a warning tone. And while I'm on the subject, it's inadvisable to wander the house at night in the home of a known rake. Your reputation could be compromised.
I'm not worried. You said the thought of seducing me would never even cross your mind.
Yes, but sometimes, he murmured, a man acts without thinking at all.
He leaned in as if to draw to her, trying to convince himself that a kiss would be for her own good. Just a little one, of course. A mere brush of his lips on hers. It wouldn't be so very terrible of him. It would be a tiny bit terrible of him, and that was the point, to put the punctuation mark on his warning. Beware, turn back, here there be monsters. He'd be doing her a favour, really.
Right.
He'd bedded Venetian acrobats, less flexible than his morality. She put a hand to his chest. Wait.
Wait, she'd said. Wait wasn't stop.
You can afford to act without thinking, she went on. But I have to reason things through.
Reason things through?
He echoed, nonplussed. Whenever I'm faced with a decision, I consider the arguments for and against.
Remind me, what decision are you facing?
Whether or not to allow you to kiss me.
He stared at her.
That was your intent, wasn't it, to kiss me?
She paled in horror.
Oh, Lord! It wasn't, was it? I've misunderstood.
No, no, he assured her. It was my intent.
Oh, she exhaled, and the pretty flush of pink returned to her cheeks. That's good.
Is it?
I'm not certain yet. The against pile is rather large. She plucked lumps of sugar from the sugar bowl and began counting them into a heap on the worktop. I'm your employee. You're my employer and a shameless rake. You're clearly trifling with me. I might lose your respect. I might lose respect for myself. I might give you the idea that I'm willing to allow further liberties, which I am not.
I never imagined you were.
But in the four pile, she gathered a cluster of sugar lumps with her right hand, adding them one by one. If it would be just the once.
It would be.
With no further entanglement.
I despise entanglements. The mere thought of them makes me itch.
And you must have accumulated some talent for kissing, considering your history. So I suppose I could do worse.
Hold a moment. Worse? He couldn't let that pass unchallenged. He lowered his voice to a seductive drawl. Sweeting, you'd be hard-pressed to do better.
Precisely, she agreed, matter-of-fact. I may as well have a pleasant experience for my first kiss.
Chase couldn't believe what he was hearing. Her first kiss? What a travesty!
That lush, rosy mouth was eminently kissable. She bit her bottom lip, as if she could sense him staring. Goodness, I suppose it could be my only kiss. That's rather lowering to contemplate, but the possibility can't be discounted. Another lump in the four heap, isn't it? Knowing that even if I die a spinster, I won't be an unkissed one.
He watched her slide another sugar lump into the pile.
If you truly make all your decisions this way, you must drive shopkeepers mad.